You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.
Hi, I'm Brennan Center Fellow Victoria Bassetti. With me are Liza Goitin and Faiza Patel, co-directors of the Brennan Center's Program on Liberty and National Security. They are co-authors of a new Brennan Center report on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. So today we're going to discuss what the Surveillance Court is, how it got started, how it got off track, and what can be done to reform it. Now, just to make things confusing, the Surveillance Court was created under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, commonly known as FISA, and the court is commonly known as the FISA Court. But since we also happen, since that also happens to be the name of one of our guests, we're going to try to refer to it as the Surveillance Court to distinguish between FISA the guest and FISA the court. So FISA. Most people probably hadn't heard of the Surveillance Court until the revelations of Edward Snowden. Just what is the Surveillance Court and how is it different from regular federal courts?
So the Surveillance Court was set up in 1978 when Congress passed the FISA statute. The FISA statute was passed in the wake of the Watergate scandals, the Church Committee, all the revelations about the misconduct by the FBI and the CIA, spying on Americans, you know, that whole conglomerate of issues. And the point of the FISA court is really to check the executive branch when it's carrying out surveillance in the name of foreign intelligence. Now, the court is made up of regular federal court judges, district court judges from around the country. They are appointed to serve on this particular court for a certain term by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. So for a few years, these federal court judges come and sit on the FISA court for a certain part of the year. The FISA court is also different from all other federal courts, though, in that it operates in almost complete secrecy. So until Edward Snowden came along, we barely had any idea as to how the FISA court was operating and what it was doing.
Liza, the court had been around for more than 30 years before the Snowden revelation, and no one really knew much about what it was doing, as FISA says. Most Americans could probably be forgiven for thinking it really didn't affect them. After all, it was supposed to only impact foreigners, and it was only supposed to be about foreign intelligence, you know, terrorism or espionage. But what did Snowden's revelations show? Why should the average American be concerned?
Snowden's revelations showed, or I should say really confirmed, that the role of the Surveillance Court has changed dramatically since it was established back in 1978. Originally, what the court was doing was reviewing applications by the government to conduct surveillance in individual cases, in cases where the target was a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. And because of changes in the law, the court now reviews applications to conduct entire programs of surveillance of foreign targets. Those targets no longer need to be foreign targets or agents or foreign powers or agents of foreign powers. And if those people are communicating with Americans, the government doesn't need an individualized order, an individualized determination of probable cause in order to collect those communications. So what the court does now is it gives its blessing to mass surveillance programs that pull in communications between Americans and foreigners overseas. And all of this has been exacerbated by changes in technology, which make it infinitely more likely that when a foreign target is communicating and these communications are being picked up, that there are Americans on one end of that communication, and sometimes Americans on both end, because the technology is such that it's not always easy to tell if an email that's in storage is between Americans or between foreigners.
Now, normally, if the government wanted to get an email or a phone record from an American, they would have to get a warrant in a court. So FISA, aside from the fact that it's secret, what's the difference between the government getting a warrant from the surveillance court and getting one from a regular federal court?
So the surveillance court does two things. The first thing it does is it makes these individualized determinations about whether or not the government can conduct surveillance on a particular person. So supposing the government wants to conduct surveillance on you for foreign intelligence purposes because it suspects you're part of a terrorist plot, for example, they could go to the FISA court and say, right, you know, Victoria seems kind of shady. We'd like to surveil her. And all they have to demonstrate to the court is probable cause that you are an agent of a foreign power, right? That you are in some way associated with some foreign terrorist group or a foreign state. They don't have to show in any great detail that you there's probable cause that you've committed a crime. Just your relationship with a foreign power is enough. So that's one set of things that the court does. The second set of things, as Liza just explained, are these mass surveillance programs, right? And that's what the Snowden archive really shows, is the court's not just issuing these individual orders, it's also basically signing off on programs like the prison program, for example, right? Which is vacuuming up information about our communications with people overseas and then analyzing them.
So when I read your report, I was really struck by the catalog of abuses that prompted the creation of the court. Faiza, you discussed the Church Committee and revelations about the CIA and FBI in the 1970s. And one example you mention is outrage that the CIA had opened 200,000 letters over a 20-year period. Those numbers and program seem sort of quaint today. So what is programmatic surveillance, and how has it affected the court? Liza?
Programmatic surveillance is surveillance of large numbers of people without any individualized finding of a link to terrorist activity or to suspected wrongdoing or anything like that. We don't have good numbers. Intelligence agencies are not exactly forthcoming with numbers, but based on one FISA court opinion that was released, we know that under one of the programmatic collection programs, which is a program to intercept communications between Americans and foreigners overseas, there were 250 million internet communications that were picked up under that program in 1 year. And that's likely dwarfed by some of the other forms of programmatic surveillance that are out there. So we are really talking about a brave new world of surveillance where ordinary citizens in this country and other countries are subject to surveillance with absolutely no showing of any reason to suspect wrongdoing.
So that could mean all of your emails between you and someone overseas, or even possibly between you and someone in the United States. It could mean phone calls. It could mean mm-hmm. the actual conversations that are occurring, not just metadata, really just the deep inside information. Faiza, is that right?
That's absolutely right. So I think it's important to draw this distinction between metadata and content, right? Because there's obviously programs that are operating that are collecting metadata. We know, for example, that there's a program that's currently in place under Section 215 of the Patriot Act that collects telephone metadata. At least until 2011, there was a program that connected internet metadata under another provision of the Patriot Act. So you've certainly got that whole set of issues. But you also have large programs that are collecting the content of communications. As you mentioned, they would pick up, you know, emails, telephone calls, instant messages, text messages, you know, other ways in which we communicate, Skype, for example. So all of these kinds of communications, which have grown exponentially in the last couple of decades, are now vulnerable to surveillance with very little oversight and no requirement of suspicion.
So there was, Liza, you wanted to say something?
I should just point out, both Faiza and I have relatives overseas who are not American citizens, but you probably, most of us do. Those people are legitimate targets. They don't have to be suspected of any affiliation with terrorism or with wrongdoing to be legitimate targets. They just have to be foreigners overseas. So our communications with those relatives, with those friends, are subject to being collected. Now, there are provisions in the law for Americans' information to be, quote-unquote, minimized. But this and that ideally would mean that they would be deleted or masked or discarded, as soon as they're collected, essentially. That's not what happens at all. Under the rules that the court has approved for minimization, the government can hold on to this information for as long as 5 years, with many, many exceptions and loopholes that allow the government to hold on to information about us, about Americans, for longer than that.
This programmatic surveillance, this mass collection of data of communications between foreigners and Americans and even possibly between Americans has been approved by the surveillance court. Has the surveillance court ever said no to a government request?
Very rarely. So there have been, according to public records, some 30,000-plus requests to the surveillance court, and less than 10 of these have been denied over the course of the last 30-odd years. And in terms of the mass surveillance programs, those have been approved by the court, as we know from decisions that have been disclosed over the last year or so.
Well, that doesn't sound like close judicial scrutiny of government requests, Liza, is it?
It's not set up to be close judicial scrutiny. In fact, the court is prohibited from reviewing the individual targets of surveillance. The court knows nothing about the individual targets of surveillance. All the court can look at is these broad procedures for determining whether the targets are in fact foreigners overseas, and broad procedures for minimization and minimizing information about U.S. persons. That's the only thing the court knows. So it is actually deliberately set up not to be close judicial scrutiny. And I should mention that the court's rate of sort of rejection of applications is not that different from the rate of regular courts that receive applications for search warrants in regular criminal cases. What has really changed is what those applications look like. So now the court is being asked to bless these huge programs, knowing nothing about the individual targets, and the court, time and again, is saying yes.
So Faiza, the problem is not only with the way the court operates, according to your report, it's also with the underlying statute that it's enforcing.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because the problem is that the laws that are governing the FISA court just don't allow it to operate like a court at all, right? When a court reviews a warrant application, it's going to look at whether or not there's probable cause, whether the government actually has a reason to go off and intercept your emails or listen to your telephone conversations. That's not what the FISA court does with mass surveillance programs. It actually is just taking a 30,000-foot view on a very complicated, technologically sophisticated program and saying, yeah, that sounds okay.
And the way that a court normally would operate, even if with the initial warrant application there might not be a defense attorney or an adversary in the court, there eventually would be an opportunity for an adversarial challenge of the warrant that produced evidence, and there would be an opportunity to appeal the court's order or to challenge the court's order. There's no such opportunity today, is there, in the Liza?
There isn't, and in fact, the system, again, is sort of set up that way because notice is not given to people who are targets of surveillance, unlike in criminal search warrant cases or electronic wiretap cases in the criminal context, where notice eventually is given to the target. Also, in criminal cases, the target will likely have a chance at some point down the road at trial to contest the validity of the search. These foreign intelligence surveillance cases are quite different because they rarely result in a criminal prosecution. So that opportunity to contest the search is not there. And really, even when a criminal prosecution happens, the government has been very creative in finding ways not to notify defendants that there has been this type of surveillance under FISA, the statute, in a way that would allow the defendant to raise a challenge.
And the court opinions are secret. They're not made public. FISA?
The FISA court opinions are secret. Until Snowden came along, we had maybe one or two opinions from the FISA court that had been made public. And since then, a slew of them have come out. A part of them, some of them were leaked by Snowden himself, but a number have been declassified by the government, partly in response to public pressure and partly in response to freedom of information litigation brought by different groups and individuals. So we have this court that's really blessing very large programs that have an impact on the lives of millions of Americans because our communications are being picked up, and it's operating completely in secret. Nobody knows what the basis of its decisions are, and yet it has this enormous impact on everybody.
So, as you say, the government is collecting all this bulk data on Americans with the surveillance court's blessing. I'm kind of reminded of that last scene in Indiana Jones, where there's a vast warehouses full of knowledge. It keeps the emails or phone calls, as you say, for a long time. And I read last year the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, whose members were all appointed by the president and which was established in the wake of the Snowden revelations. They were worried that the intelligence community wasn't really assessing the value of its program. The report said determining determining, and I'm quoting, that determining the efficacy and value of particular counterterrorism programs is critical. Without such determinations, policymakers and courts cannot effectively weigh the interests of the government in conducting a program against the intrusions on privacy and civil liberties that it may cause. So, Liza, does the intelligence community have a way to evaluate the value of the hundreds of millions of records they have on Americans? Does the court evaluate the value of the program?
That's a question the court does not look at in any context. It's certainly a question that the government has the ability and, I would argue, the obligation to do. I'm sure this isn't unique to intelligence agencies, but intelligence agencies happen to be extremely remiss in terms of conducting these types of efficacy evaluations of the program, of these multi-million, multi-billion dollar programs that they have in place, these very intrusive programs. And in fact, the agencies seem resistant to the notion that efficacy should matter in this collection effort. If you look at the Section 215 program, that is the bulk collection of Americans' metadata, there is now pretty good public evidence that this program has had little to no value added over the traditional way of getting these records, which is individualized, based on individualized suspicion. That's been the finding of two independent panels that looked at this, and essentially the government's own admissions in testimony before Congress has basically confirmed this program just didn't have very much value. Even so, the administration is absolutely committed to continuing it in some form. It's working to try to get legislation that would alter it and that would include more protections, but it will not stop this bulk collection program, which has had no value.
And when it comes to the way the intelligence agencies operate in front of this court, they say they need this different standard. They say they need this data, they need these programs, and they need the surveillance court to operate using different legal standards that it would for other kind of surveillance programs, non-foreign intelligence surveillance programs. In fact, they might even say that any court review hinders them. And they say secrecy, speed, and discretion are vital to protect national security. FISA, are they wrong?
No, they're not wrong. Secrecy, speed, and discretion are, in fact, important for national security purposes. But the problem is that there's too much secrecy and too much discretion. I can't comment on speed. If you just look at the secrecy issue, right, until Snowden came along, all of these things were considered to be highly classified. Nobody could know about it because it would cause really massive damage to our national security. Here we are a year and a half later, and not only do we have the information that's coming out of Snowden, but the government itself has declassified large amounts of information, including FISA court orders that were completely taboo until now. So obviously there is a better balance that we can reach as between secrecy and the public's right to know what the government is doing.
Now, your report goes into this in really great detail and is an amazing read. It's a little bit of a frightening read, too.
Oh, good. We served our purpose.
And I think it's really informative. It's a really eye-opening report. We've gone through some of the problems with the court, but you have some proposals. You have some specific ideas for how the court and the underlying statute ought to be reformed. Why don't we start with Liza telling us a few of the proposals and then switch over to FISA, kind of wrapping it up.
Sure. I think the first and most important proposal is to end programmatic collection, because programmatic collection is not something that a court can approve consistent with the traditional role in our Constitution of a court. Programmatic collection also has serious constitutional ramifications in terms of the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans who get swept up in this collection. So programmatic collection is problematic both from the point of view of what it's done to the court, how it's kind of warped the role of the court, and what it's done to our privacy as Americans. So that's really our first recommendation. And then we have some other recommendations that would help shore up some of the constitutional issues.
So, FISA, there are also some specific improvements to the way the court operates that you advocate.
Right. So we'd like the court to act more like a regular court in the sense of we'd like it to have a greater role in evaluating the government submissions. We think it's really important to have a robust adversary in the court. Right now, the court hears only from the government in 99% of its cases, and there's nobody to represent the opposite side, right, to represent the public interest. And we think it's really important to have a robust public advocate in there who's going to point out to the court the problems with what the government's saying.
Now, that public advocate isn't going to go out and have press conferences or tell the target what's about to happen.
No, of course not. Yeah. I mean, this would be somebody who is cleared, who has access to classified information, who is able to actually evaluate the record that the government is putting forward. This person could report to Congress. You know, there could be reporting that was more public, but certainly the idea is to have something that's closer to our notion of a traditional adversarial proceeding in the surveillance court. The third thing that we'd really like to see is greater transparency. As I said, we've seen that the Intelligence Committee can release FISA court decisions, and it's really important that it does so, particularly for decisions that have a huge impact on the legal framework. Until Snowden came along, for some issues, we just didn't understand the legal framework, what the court's interpretation was. It was secret law. We need to get away from that, and so there needs to be a systematic way to put things forward. And lastly, as you mentioned, Victoria, warrants are generally subject to challenge at a later point in time. The way the law is currently structured, it makes it very difficult for somebody to challenge a FISA court order on surveillance. And there are steps that Congress can take to make it easier for people to actually do that and therefore test the FISA court's case law in regular federal court.
So I have one last question. So after the Snowden revelations, there was quite a hue and cry about what he revealed. A fair number of commissions were established. Some congressional investigations were launched. Has anything happened? And what's it going to take for the recommendations in your report to be implemented or seriously considered by policymakers? Liza?
There have been some changes over the past year at the administrative level. So the administration, for example, has voluntarily asked the FISA court to review the individual queries that it performs on Americans' telephone metadata, which the government is still collecting in bulk. But really, there needs to be legislative action and a fundamental overhaul of the system. We've got two opportunities to do that coming up. The Patriot Act is expiring in 2015, and the FISA statute itself is expiring in 2017. Those are great opportunities. In order to make it happen, I think it's important that people have the information about what these programs are, what they're doing, and how they've strayed from the original sort of intentions behind the FISA court and the entire foreign intelligence surveillance system. And so I would urge everybody to read our report and to really, you know, start thinking about these issues in a deep way.
Okay, well, we're going to have to end it here. Thanks to FISA and Liza. You can find the full report on the Brennan Center's website, which is brennancenter.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for one of the Brennan Center's informative newsletters. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And for the Brennan Center, I'm Victoria Bassetti.